From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Nguyen announcing show number 676, Operations Runbooks in Octopus Deploy with guest Michael Richardson. Recorded Saturday, January 25th, 2020. Run As Radio is produced each week by Sound Thoughts LLC. For more information, visit soundthoughtsllc.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell. Thanks for listening to Run As Radio. My guest today is Michael Richardson, who's the VP of Product at Octopus Deploy. Octopus is a tool to manage releases and automate deployments and operations, and this means Michael spends much of his time talking with organizations about their challenges implementing DevOps and designing solutions to help. And before joining Octopus, he spent over 10 years as a consultant, software engineer, mostly in the .NET space, and today he lives in Brisbane, Australia, and has a degree in software engineering from the QUT. So actually educated in software engineering. You're a real engineer as opposed to the rest of us that are faking it.
Oh, I still feel like I'm faking it, Richard. Don't worry about that. I make it up as I go every day.
Imposter syndrome just means you're self-aware, really.
Well, I'm sitting here talking to Richard Campbell, who I've spent many years of my life listening to, so it's very real right now.
Well, you know, let's get to the truth, which is the guests are the experts. I just help them tell their story. So today, you are the expert, sir.
Yeah, I think you're a little modest there. Your depth of knowledge on everything I've heard you speak about is pretty deep, so...
I'm good at remembering things, and I do love telling a good story. Yeah. But let's dive into this, because I've always known, I mean, we've talked about Octopus Deploy on .NET Rocks before. I think we've talked about it on RunAs before as well. It's definitely, you know, here's this third-party approach comprehensively to deployment, which touches, you know, that's where the rubber hits the road between dev and ops when we actually put software into production.
Absolutely. The runbooks idea is focusing a little more on the ops side of that DevOps.
Yeah, because normally I think in terms of Octopus Deploy as a product that devs care about, although you always have this conversation with operations about how we want to push software to test platforms and so forth. And that means invariably, because I remember, a conversation about the tentacle, right? About an agent that needs to run on the machine.
That's right. And I mean, if we're serious about the idea of DevOps, mm-hmm. then our role as software developers definitely doesn't stop when the software is deployed, right? We need to keep this thing running. Runbooks, in some ways, aren't quite as glamorous as deployments, but they're what makes the world go round. They're the routine maintenance tasks that keeps everything running.
All right. So, and they work off the back of a tentacle. So this is an idea that since we have this agent on the machine for deployment, let's do some more useful things.
Exactly. So Octopus is in a nice place to help here because it already knows about your infrastructure. You've already given it the trust to be able to run on that infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So it's in the perfect place to be able to run operations tasks as well. It already knows about the details of the application that you deployed because most operations tasks are all about keeping the application running. I mean, there's some that are focused on infrastructure, but in general, it's about keeping that application alive.
So right, and healthy.
Octopus already knows about the connection strings, the passwords, all the secrets.
Right. So rather than me having to bring in another tool and map all of those things in, here's a tool that's already there and kind of knows its way around it.
Exactly. And this was not a big stretch for us. You know, sometimes when you're designing a new feature, you're worried, are people going to use this? This wasn't that. And the reason why was that we saw all of our customers were doing this anyway. They were using Octopus to run these tasks anyway. They had to model them as deployments, mm-hmm. and it just didn't quite fit. The terminology isn't right. The semantics aren't right. So, yeah.
So, instead of a deployment, what are we actually talking about? Typical runbook, just like a backup and a restore?
Backup and restore is a very typical thing. One thing we've seen the way people use these is they're far less homogenous than deployments. Like in a way, every deployment to the same thing is kind of the same, but with runbooks, they're very wide and varied. But yeah, we definitely see a few general patterns of things people do. Backup and restores, cutting over to disaster recovery, mm-hmm. restarting IIS, cleaning up files, all these type of things that keep your application alive. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's normal when we deploy a new version to say to hop IIS. Look, I'm mixing terminology like crazy today, but exactly that. So it sees the new version. But you're saying take advantage of Tentacle to be able to just say, hey, something's a little weird with the website. We don't actually need to move any new bytes around. But let's just kick IIS today.
Yeah, let's you know, if we're honest, who hasn't worked on a project before where they've had to restart IIS every now and then to clear some memory or make it work again. That's right, exactly.
By default, it restarts itself, right?
Right. Do you remember when you used to be able to schedule that and it had some super weird set time that it would do it on so that it rotated and was at a different time every day?
I ran into that. I think it's 21 hours. I think I remember
something like that. Yeah, 21
and
hours.
And I made the mistake when I was doing a talk once at TechEd about mentioning that the default for restarting the worker process was 21 hours. It says, I don't know why it's 21 hours. It makes no sense to me, but that's what it is. And you can't say stuff like that at TechEd because the guy who set that number, he was at the back of the room.
Right.
And he
had a very good reason for setting it at the time, I'm sure.
He came and told me. And the reason was it makes tech support for Microsoft cheaper.
To rotate around the clock to spread the load across for their tech support.
Well, no, this is why. When you call in saying, I have this weird problem with my app, but it happens 3 hours earlier each day, they know immediately it's the worker process restarting.
That is very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
It said that, and so that's why it's cheaper for Microsoft, because it helps them quickly diagnose, the only thing that shifts for 3 hours every day is the default setting for worker process restarts.
All right. I'll have to remember that lesson.
Well, you guys make a product. Like, you've got common tech support items you probably get. The idea that you could set defaults to help you catch those quicker and help people get going sooner, it's kind of a clever idea.
Oh, no, I'm writing it down right now. Believe me, it's very neat.
Those guys.
You just saved us some money, Richard. Thank you very much.
You come on my show and help me, you know, help me make shows, and we trade back and forth. It's all good stuff.
You can give us the consulting bill at the end.
That's a good one. I like that. So, is your Runbook's really about disaster recovery? I could also imagine, do you have a Runbook for like a rollback? We get a problem with a version, we got to drop back to another version?
Yeah, I think so. Restoring a database is one of the big use cases for Runbooks, but not just in the production scenario, but also back to test environments as well. So when you're developing software, often you want to take the exact database that's in production and restore it into a test environment so that you can test. And you may want to configure some data scrubbing of sensitive data to happen as part of that. And, you know, having to go and ask the DBA to do this for you every time gets a little monotonous as well. So again, Octopus already knows about the infrastructure that's in all those test environments.
Right.
So it makes sense to run it from there. And we also see runbooks get run before deployments. We see them being used for infrastructure provisioning, for making sure all the dependencies are installed on a machine. And again, this is nice too, because you can run this on your test environments as well to make sure they have the exact same set of pre-installed software as the production servers.
Right. All the way to just sort of match environments and make sure that all those things are consistent. One of those core tenets of DevOps, right? That development, test, and production should look the same.
Even right back to developer workstations, I've spoken to people who are using that same approach now. Whenever they spin up a new developer workstation, they run the exact same process that they run against their production servers against their developer workstation to make sure their environments are mirroring production.
And so you guys taking on the Runbooks problem is me no longer having to own that code. It's now a tool I have.
Yeah. Well, do you know the way that we see a lot of people, because, you know, traditionally, historically, Runbook was a physical document as well, obviously, where we're talking about an automated process here, but the way we see this in real life is it's often a hybrid of a text document and an automated document. So people will have a document in Confluence or a markdown document in GitHub, and it will describe literally, if this problem occurs, then run this runbook. And sometimes that might be a script embedded in the document. Sometimes it might point at source control to get it from.
Right.
And that's fine. That works. But it's got a few gaps in it as well, right? And one of the big ones is permissions. To take a script and execute it against a machine means the person doing that has to have permissions against that machine, enough permissions to run that script.
And we get back to that whole trap of super users where it's like, I have all the privileges, I can run whatever I want. Oops, I meant to run that against tests and I just ran it against production. Ha ha.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a good point, because you also don't get the auditing when you run a script like that as well. So when a problem happens and the poor ops guy in the middle of the night is trying to figure out what went wrong, they can't see that somebody ran that script. So I think the auditing side is really important too. But having the ability to let anyone run those processes without necessarily having to have permissions to the machines directly is pretty powerful. Mm-hmm. I think this is one of the things that tools like Octopus Deploy did for deployments originally, was democratize them a bit so that it was no longer just the developers or the ops folks that could do deployments. Now the testing team or the QA team or the release manager could now do their own deployments into their environments. And hopefully this can do the same for runbooks.
Yeah. And granularize those rights a bit more. So you have a right to execute a script, but you don't have the rights that script has.
That's right. And even more granular than that, you have the rights to run this in this environment, but you don't have the rights to run this in this environment.
Right.
So you can run a database restore, for example, into test. That's fine. You can't run it into production.
Yeah. Just don't give you that option. And let's be clear, you don't want that capability, because if you have that capability, then it could be your fault.
Oh, absolutely. As a developer, I don't want access to production at all. I want query access, and that's it.
Yeah. Even then, it's like, you can make copies of data, put it on another machine that I can then look at. I'd rather not touch your production servers in any way, so that you don't look at me when something happens in production. It wasn't me. I can't do that.
Look, if there's one thing you can count on humans for, it's making mistakes, right?
Yeah, sure.
So, let's not let that happen.
Yeah, set the good restrictions around that. When we do that sort of failure analysis part and say, how did we get here? It's like, you know, the answer can't be more careful next time. It needs to be, it just doesn't give you that option. You want to break glass to be able to do this.
No, look at any incident in history and chances are you don't have to dig too deep to find the mistake that a human made as part of it.
It's just a normal part of the equation regardless.
Right.
So I do appreciate all that. And again, it's like building this into runbooks, into code, means you only have to figure out those rights models and different role privileges once, and then you just have to have access to the script.
Yeah, that's right. And there's also a self-service aspect to it as well.
Yeah.
Like if you're a DBA and you can now expose even just query scripts that someone can run along and get their own data rather than having to rely on you to run these, or again, relying on you to give them the scripts and give them the right access rights.
Yeah.
That providing that interface is pretty powerful as well.
Yeah. So you're taking stress off of other people, more self-service that's properly safe. Like, I do like the idea of, I want to pull a copy of the production database, I want to scrub it for PII, and then make it available in tests so we can run these tests on as realistic a data set as I possibly can get.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, there's some great tools now to be able to do that scrubbing part as well. Redgate makes some nice data scrubbing
tools. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and absolutely worthwhile spending some energy on it. So it does sound like I need to be in the Octopus Deploy world to really take advantage of runbooks.
Yeah, that's true. At least our version of them as well. And this is a feature that will probably make the most sense to people who are already using Octopus. That's right. It's one more string to its bow, if you like.
Yeah, I guess it's a question of, is this a facilitator? Like, I like this so much, I'm going to get into you as my deployment tool versus with you going the other way. Oh, you're using a deployment tool, you ought to be using the runbooks too.
I think it's a little bit of both, hopefully.
Yeah.
It's a new feature for us. We only launched it last month, so we'll find out as time goes by.
So you really just got the V1 out. You're in the early days.
Yeah, we made the 2019 cutoff to get it out. It's proved very popular so far. The uptake's been as fast as anything we shipped for a long time. So I think, and that was for the reasons I mentioned before, I think it was such a natural fit, and it was something that people were doing anyway.
Yeah.
That it makes adoption pretty easy.
Well, and from an IP perspective, it's like, if I've already got the tentacle on the machine, I'd rather not have another piece of software on the machine. So make it smarter and we can do more useful things.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, there's so many tools in the DevOps space now the reality is it's a giant space and none of them can do everything.
No.
So it's about choosing the tools that are right for you and the different parts of that pipeline.
Yeah, drawing the line where it makes sense for you. Absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah. There's no simple answer there. And Michael, I'm going to interrupt for one moment for this very important message. If keeping up with the growing amount of security patches and managing complex Microsoft in-place upgrades are becoming a pain point within your IT department, Barramundi Management Suite is the solution. The Barramundi Management Suite gives you real-time lifecycle management of all network endpoints, from classic Windows and Mac to iOS and Android devices. Barramundi software automates time-consuming tasks, including Windows migration, software installation, inventory, and backup. Whether you manage IT for a small company or a global corporation, Barramundi optimizes endpoint management, frees time for new projects, and reduces IT costs. Check out www.barramundisoftware.com to receive your Run As Radio 25% discount and info for a 30-day trial. And we're back. It's Run As Radio. I'm Richard Campbell, and that is Michael Richardson from Octopus Deploy. We're talking a little bit about operational runbooks. And I'm thinking about complicated runbooks, and I'm going to bet that the failover to a new site is probably the trickiest runbook of all. Actually, that's not true. There's one trick here. Fail back.
Yeah, so this you're talking about a disaster recovery scenario?
Yeah, or a failover to the other data center, right?
That's right. And this falls into so many of the other types of runbooks as well, which is that one day, one way or another, you're going to have to deal with this. And it really just comes down to how much prep you've done beforehand to bad that scenario is going to be. Because in a perfect world for a disaster recovery failover, every time you've deployed to production, you've also deployed to your disaster recovery site.
Yep.
And switching between the two should be as simple as flipping the load balancer to point to a different site. The reality is not always that, as you probably know.
Well, just like we don't actually need a backup strategy. We need a restore strategy. It turns out you can't have a restore strategy without a backup, but if you haven't done a restore, you don't actually have a backup.
No, that's right. And the whole idea of rollbacks, I mean, we've a long time ago landed on the fact that there's no such thing as a rollback. It's everything's a roll forward in one way or another.
Yeah.
It's only what you can do from here to get your system back to a running state. And disaster recovery, probably as much as anything else, falls into that category of you need to do it when you don't need to do it, so that when you do need to do it, it's a trivial operation. And the first step to making that a reality is automating it, right? Because if it takes hours and lots of manual effort to fail over to your disaster recovery site, you're not going to practice it very often, are you?
No, I got to a point with one organization, and this was working in the Caribbean. We had data centers in Bermuda, we had data centers in Cayman. So you can imagine what the business was.
Right.
And of course, they both have hurricanes, but they don't have hurricanes at the same time. And we practiced failovers. But whenever we practiced a failover, all the best people were there.
Yeah, right.
It was the most experienced team. And I remember the CTO coming at me and saying, how do I get the rest of the teams comfortable too, like the coaching and so forth? So what if we just failed over every month?
Well, you could just make sure that disasters only happen during business hours. That would be easy, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So what we started doing was failing over every month until the A team got bored.
Right.
Like within 3 months of it failing over perfectly, you know, we were just switching between the data centers every month. Some of the 18 guys didn't show up. And so the B team started to learn because it got boring.
That's one strategy. Just make it so routine.
Well, and you talked about automation, like the automation of, okay, push the button. Now monitor the numbers. Okay, we've moved. Thanks for playing. Well, I'm not going to show next week. I'm just going to get lunch.
That's right. That Confluence document that I was talking about earlier that explains how to do something, in our ideal world, that should have one step in it. It should be go here and click
the green this. Button. Right.
And actually, you know, the disaster recovery scenario, I know I don't need to tell you this more than anyone, but it's like a lot of the deployment scenarios as well, in that everything's easy until you get to the database, right?
Oh.
I can create a disaster recovery failover for stateless app servers very easily. It's always the database where it gets complicated.
Yeah. And there's that assessment moment of, do we go to the backup that's a day old? Do we try and get what's currently on fire so that we have, you know, lose less data? Like, you know, what that whole debate of how quickly we need to be up versus how much data is going to be missing.
That's right. How much are we going to lose if we do this? Mm-hmm. Is that acceptable? Yep. It's very same with the blue-green deployment strategy. Every blog post you read about a blue-green deployment strategy always makes it look easy because they never talk about the database.
Right.
It's always the database that's hard to keep supporting two versions at the same time.
Yeah.
And disaster recovery is, I think, a similar flavor of the same problem. This is why DBAs earn their money, right?
Yeah, but it's that moment. And I've been the guy who we restored from yesterday's backup and then continued on with a hole of data and then spent 3 months salvaging what we could from the failed machine to fill in that hole. And yet, you know, you never really are going to know if you got all the data, but you scrounged as much as you could.
Right. Yep. And I guess one of the things that we looked at as well when we were building this feature is what's the life cycle of a runbook? Mm-hmm. You know, for a deployment, we kind of modeled this using environments and progression and releases. None of that quite fits for a runbook. And yet a runbook evolves just like anything else, right?
I mean, it's source code in the end, right?
It's source code. It's just as important as your deployment process or your application code.
Right.
To a user, a user doesn't care why your site's down, right?
No.
And what we saw was that even these tools that let you run runbooks. So you create your runbook, you automate it. This is great. You've got it running on a schedule. Fantastic. People can run it whenever they like themselves. Except now, how do you modify that thing? How do you safely make changes to it?
Yeah.
Now that you have to treat this.
It's source code. You need to be able to check that in. You need to be revert to an old version. You need to know who made the changes so you know which neck to throttle.
Exactly. And sometimes you need to do this at 2 a.m. in the morning.
Right.
When the world's on fire.
Yeah, the right person to call. So is that part of the equation? What does a runbook ultimately look like? Does it manifest as a file that I can make copies of and move around?
It manifests as a series of steps, which may be script files. They may be built-in steps. And we introduced the concept of publishing as well to handle that scenario that you want to make changes to this. You want to update the packages that the runbook depends on, because often you depend on external tools as part of a runbook.
Sure.
You want to be able to change the script, and you want to test that in another environment. And you want to do all this while the published version is still sitting there stable, being executed on that schedule.
Well, again, I'm thinking very GitHub-y, like I want to be on a branch right now where I'm experimenting with these new capabilities and at some point merge it back into the main, to the master for this runbook.
Exactly. So you're testing all your scripts off the branch or your packages that are built off the branch. And then once you as the maintainer of that runbook are happy with it, you hit the publish button and then it becomes the version.
Right.
Because one thing that we realized that runbooks were different to deployments as well is, when you're deploying an application, you typically have many different versions of that application in flight at once, right? Like you've got your production version that's one version. You've got another version that's in test. Actually, you've probably got three other versions in test at once. You've got this whole staged rollout of all these different versions. Runbooks don't quite work like that. When it's 2 a.m. and you need to hit the button to make the disaster recovery happen, you don't want to have to think about which version of this thing am I supposed to be running. You want there to be one version, right?
Yeah.
The version.
But but it's not a bad thing to see the past versions, right?
No, it's really important to be able to see it for the comfort of you running it. There's a very different feeling to seeing, hey, this thing ran successfully at 3 p.m. yesterday to, hey, this thing ran successfully 400 days ago. Those are two very different things.
Yeah.
So you're right.
Yeah. And definitely you want to know, you know, again, we get back to that source code control side of it. It's an interesting place that we're in IT now where we're making things that we do want more than one person to be able to maintain and operate from. I mean, for a long time, those scripts were very personal. Like I kept them on my 3.5-inch floppy because I'm that old, or my USB key. But today, no, they need to be in a repository with clear record keeping.
Absolutely. I think this is ultimately what DevOps is all about. It's about letting multiple teams interact on that. It's democratizing that development and operations, I think.
Well, and just acknowledging that IT folks write code too. They just happen to be deployment scripts or, you know, database migration scripts. And that's all code. And it should be managed the same way. It should be part of the package.
Right. And in any real world big organization, typical enterprise, many different people and teams take part in the process of releasing and maintaining software, right? It's not like you just have your three developers who own this entire thing through production. That's not how it works.
Yeah. Arguably, there's just too many different skills involved. It's enough to be able to get the code to run reliably, then also build the test harnesses and also deal with all of the cloud deployment issues. Like there's just too many skills needed to do this all. That's why we have teams.
Absolutely. And the fact that everyone cares about this, everyone wants to know which version is in production because it matters to their users. So it matters to them.
It's
software. Every company became a software company at some point.
Various different skills that are needed. So can I check a runbook into GitHub?
You can check all the various components of the runbook into GitHub.
Okay.
So the scripts that each step runs. We are working right now on adding source control for the whole thing.
For the runbook itself.
Where you'll be able to check the actual process itself in.
And like you said, you shipped V1 the MVP in December, and here we are in February. So
exactly.
Coming.
It will evolve quickly from here.
Right. Yeah. Still got a ways to go for all of those things.
I think the next step that will be fun as well is to move a little up the abstraction ladder too. So the ability to run runbooks is great. I'm looking forward to seeing some of the common problems that people are trying to solve with them and building some more first-class solutions to those too. Like I think things like renewing certificates and automatically rolling them out, I think tooling can help a lot here.
Yeah, it's interesting how difficult that is when certificates expire.
It's something that everyone needs to deal with, and it's hard.
Yeah, and it doesn't happen often enough for you to ever be good at it.
No, that's exactly right. If you have to do it once a year, again, it falls into that nasty gap of just enough to cause you problems, but not enough to...
And not often enough for you to remember where you put your notes last time.
That's right. So something like Let's Encrypt is great here because it sort of really forces you to automate that process and do it regularly. And I think building support for something like that would really help the adoption of that approach too.
So a runbook for renewing a cert?
Exactly.
That's where we are.
And there's a lot of steps in that little dance that you have to do, but there's a lot of value to be added there as well.
Yeah. And there's definitely right ways and wrong ways to go down those paths too. So,
that's right.
Being smart about it.
Yeah, and every application's a little bit different for how you have to push that renewed certificate out to it as well. So renewing the certificate's one thing, but actually getting it then into your application to the user.
Yeah, without causing huge grief in the process.
Right.
You know, you think we'd use more certs if it was easier.
I think you're probably right. It's amazing to me how often you see major websites down because the certificate is out of date.
Well, I'm even thinking on the .NET side too, right? Where you've got signed assemblies. And when those things expire, wow, it's like everybody simply lights their hair on fire and starts running around in circles. Like, we are not in a happy place.
Yeah, or even when... Yeah, no, you're exactly right. Yep, that's right.
Yeah, because, I mean, in some ways, HTTPS, like straight up TLS certificates, you know, there's pretty good documentation out there. Yeah, setting up your Exchange one's different than setting up a website one, but boy, oh boy, when you talk about application-centric certification, blah, bad. No,
it's harder than it should be, right?
Yeah, it's much harder. And I still firmly of the, I would love to get to a place where we were distributing client certs to our users, much less our customers, so that we actually had two-sided encryption. But it's just impossible. You start talking about managing hundreds of those things based on individuals. I think I'd rather stick needles in my eyes.
I can definitely agree with that. I did a job at the Australian Tax Office many years ago, and we took that exact approach of shipping client certificates for secure communication to a whole lot of businesses. And the support for that was not fun.
No.
I can vouch for that.
Now it ends up eating up all of the energy, and everybody's frustrated. And as soon as you get to that level of frustration, and we've seen this in all these different things, people just find workarounds. I'm not going to solve it for you. I'm just going to find a way to get my job done.
Agreed.
Yeah, and they're going to blow up your, and that blows up your certificate process in while doing that. Oh well, at least I got my job done.
They're one of those things that's such a fundamental, foundational part of so much of the way the internet works now, right?
It
should be anyway. Yeah. And yet the processes around them are still pretty brutal. Immature in many cases.
So how do folks get started with the runbooks? Presumably they better get involved in Octopus Deploy pretty quickly.
That would definitely help. That would be a first step. And once in, you really can't miss them now. They sit right on the side menu next to deployments, basically. This is not something that we wanted to hide away and make it a little niche feature.
And is it now just the main way that you do deployments in Octopus Deploy? Like, you've just sort of grown out a console for deployment versus the older versions where it wasn't that big of a thing?
Yeah, that's right. We still treat the deployment process, because let's face it, a deployment process is just a version of a Rumble, right?
It's one of them. The one you used to, the only one you used to have. Yeah.
But yeah, the deployment process does get a little bit of special treatment and love in Octopus for the reasons I think I alluded to before. It kind of gets snapshotted in a release. It gets given a version. So it's a little bit different.
Right.
Essentially, you're right. We model it behind the scenes as it's just a runbook as well.
All those same things. And so where do folks still go to learn more?
Octopus.com.
Ah, this is a great domain name. It was taking a while to land that one.
Yeah, I don't think it was cheap somehow.
Well, this is great stuff, Michael. I appreciate you bringing it to the show.
Not at all. Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
You bet. And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.